region that is filled with deception, where political action was not genuine, but merely the reception of orders from external forces. Yet he stood as the true model, confronting the great but unjust and malevolent powers that dominate. And so his path became a beacon for all liberation movements worldwide, imposing itself on the political landscape of the region and setting a standard that ultimately others find difficult to reach. Sayyid Nasrallah was a man who elevated and advanced everything around him. Under him, Lebanon became the focus of global attention. And everyone, I mean everyone, benefited from his contributions. His influence was not only limited to his supporters alone. Even his enemies and his adversaries began to adopt his methods of work, his political maneuvering, seeking to refine their performance and to elevate their political actions. And so due to his immense influence, it was expected that inevitably he would be met with an equal counterforce. If you want to know the value of something, look at what's standing in the way of it. In this case, it was 84 tons of explosives on his body.
Thank you, Batul. Sayyid Mohsin Abbas, welcome to the program. Good to have you join us. First off, our condolences to, once again, for Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and Sayyid Hashim Safieddine's passing. Your initial thoughts on the late Hezbollah leader's legacy and the charismatic persona that's going to stay with us for years ahead?
Yes, my condolences to all of humanity, because Sayyid Nasrallah was not just for the Lebanese people. He wasn't just a figure who stood for the Hezbollah movement. He is someone who I think who transcends all of these boundaries and barriers. In the end, what really shines for me is that virtually every one of the resistance axis leaders, you'll note one thing that they have in common. They have a prophetic virtue ethics. You know, you look at Sheikh Zakzaki, who was there today, you look at Sayyid Khamenei, you look at any of the leaders, name any of them that are prominent, even within the movement of the Houthis, and you will see this one shining value which comes out, which is their virtues, is their honor, their sacrifice, their loyalty, their sense of love and respect. But also, they then embody and represent role models which actually people don't just follow as political leaders, but in reality, they follow them as good human beings. So whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, if you really get beyond the Israeli Hasbara, which is obviously widespread across the world, what you'll find is a man who represents the most wholesome of personalities of men. And I think that's the big takeaway. And that's why you can't destroy a man like Sayyid Nasrallah. You can't kill him because he's an institution in his own right now. And he's as a martyr, you know, we Muslims, obviously we know very well that martyrs don't die. And so all that's happened is through this martyrdom is that Israelis have really really put a nail in their coffin, which is very, very secure. I mean, the reality of the matter is that Israel now, if you look at what they've done, yes, okay, you've killed Sayyid Safieddine, you've killed Sayyid Nasrallah, but what have you bought in return? You've bought $67 billion of loss, an Eilat port which is bankrupt, hundreds of thousands displaced. You've bought yourself a defeat at the hands of a barely trained Palestinian resistance, and you've got a million or so Israelis who have now done an exodus. And at the end, what they achieved is a labeling of them as terrorists on a level which has never been seen before. You know, the terrorism they did in terms of the pagers that they detonated amongst the Lebanese civilian population, that has not gone from their memory. But all of this is thanks, I think, very much to the steadfastness of Sayyid Nasrallah, his ability to convert Hezbollah from being simply a little military set of cells, operating in a kind of resistance mode, which also ultimately defeated a 15-year Israeli occupation, to actually a force which not only provided social services, medical services, served Christian, Muslim, whoever, which actually gave the Lebanese a sense of, protection and safety. But he's also fought for the freedom of the Syrians, sadly, something which hasn't lasted. But we can't forget that the levels of victories which Sayyid Nasrallah has overseen are too innumerable to mention within one program. But I'll try and get back to more of them, perhaps in later questions.
Right. And Batul, would you like to weigh in on that? How do you see Sayed Hassan's impact on not just Lebanese, but also regional resistance over the past 30 plus years?
Yes, absolutely. In terms of Lebanon and the region, so he spared the country of Lebanon from civil war by preventing it and refusing to basically be dragged into strife. He raised the level of revolutionary movements as they strove to match him. He provided all the party's expertise to the surrounding resistance movements in the region with boundless generosity. There was selflessness. He prioritized them, even if they disagreed with him. There was an exchange of expertise, generosity in giving. So Sayed Nasrallah ultimately elevated Lebanon to another level as well. Sayed Nasrallah kept the global powers on edge. They were constantly concerned. The weight of the resistance necessitated an equivalent counterweight from the West. So they mobilized all of their machinery to attack the resistance throughout these years. And the counterweights were not in equal measure. And so that ultimately allowed them to advance. We saw how the colonial forces moved to defend their pet project Israel, the occupation entity. We saw how Sayed Nasrallah turned the previously prevailing surrender in the region prior to 1982, when the resistance was formed, into an arena of active confrontation that effectively kicked the Zionists out in 2000 and liberated the country. There had been some confrontations prior to 1982, but ultimately he came and he gave it an authentic and effective, a sincere and a significantly more serious dimension. Sayed awakened the consciousness of the nation and the religious path that was asleep. Instead, he activated the religious path of sacrifice. For this reason, he, you know, constantly focused on the topic of Imam Hussein and martyrdom within his speeches, you know, considering the Imam to be a pioneer of liberation movements and the ultimate model who sacrificed himself for the survival and for the salvation and the revival of the nation. So he, Sayyid Nasrallah, revived this through his martyrdom. And we're seeing that the nation has ultimately been revived through the slogans that he raised during his lifetime, which after his death has now been turned into a kind of flood. It's been turned into a volcano. For when a leader sacrifices himself, that's when the concepts transform into life and movement within the people. So what's happened is you've got a quantity of people who have now turned into mass quality. And the taxation for this transformation process is ultimately the blood.
Thank you. And Sayed, say as a leadership, how do you see his persona, which obviously shined through his leadership, how do you see it having impacted over the years the spiritual and political trajectory of not just Hezbollah, but also the military strength of the Lebanese resistance movement?
Well, of course, Lebanon is very cosmopolitan. There are Christians, Druze, and there are Sunni Muslims. So it's a very diverse society. And I think one of the things that's underestimated is how Sayed Nasrallah managed to navigate this entire cosmopolitan environment with a spiritual character and with a religious identity still intact. And yet he's managed to win friends and create unity and keep that country as together as possible, because don't forget, before the emergence of Hezbollah and before Israel had occupied that land, there had been an absolutely devastating war, a vicious internal civil war. So getting Lebanon not to spiral back into that has been a major achievement by Sayed Nasrallah, by basically, even though he was politically, as a party, were powerful and strong and were dominant, really. But he didn't impose that domination. He tried to work in a fraternal way with all the forces. And he's also offered Hezbollah sacrifices, the sacrifices of his men for the sake of Lebanon, where others haven't stood up. Let's face it, the Lebanese army itself has done next to nothing, or had to do next to nothing, because Hezbollah have done that. And all of this, ultimately, when you talk about his personality, this man rather like all the other Hezbollah warriors, and even the ones before him, even stretching back as far as Abbas Mousavi or Sayyid Moussa Sadr, all of these leaders, if you look within the Lebanon fraternity, Imad Mughniyeh, they were all forged in the crucible of conflict. They were forged in wars, sieges, assassination attempts, relentless psyops. Sayyid Nasrallah, more so than anybody. You know, he survived so many assassination attempts, and he had to live this life of basically a kind of a warrior in constant daily recognition that he could be killed at any time. But he embraced that. He sacrificed his own son as well during the course of this process. And he was a real living example for the Lebanese people. And let's face it, across the Muslim world, the temptation for Muslims to wilt and to become neoliberal, to go for the materialist line, to buy into the American so-called dream, to do what the Saudis and to do what the Kuwaitis and all the other Khaliji Arabs have been doing for decades now, basically selling their souls to the devil, siphoning off the money of their nations, selling out their people, selling off their dignity, serving in humiliation to an Anglo-Zionist empire, trying to normalize with Israel. You see, Sayyid Nasrallah gave the Arabs pride. I say the Arabs because, of course, prior to this, there'd been no victory by any Arab army against Israel. It's Sayyid Nasrallah and the victories of 2000 and 2006 which really decimated Israeli invincibility, and he's continued to do that, because in this particular round, Sayyid Nasrallah's tactics and the training of his army has led to basically IDF again, or the IOF, I should call it, being again humiliated. They couldn't move virtually, you know, a matter of meters or inches into the territory of Lebanon beyond what has allowed them to. They basically were unable to achieve any of their objectives of reoccupying Lebanon, all because of the organization, the military organization, which was there, which was done under the auspices of Sayyid Nasrallah. The political organization held Lebanon together. And the reality of the matter is, in this last war, I don't think that Israel would have achieved even the ceasefire that they begged, basically, to get going, had it not been for the fact that they were bombing civilians, and also civilians who weren't necessarily Hezbollah civilians. So they were killing people who were Christians and others in order to make them tell Hezbollah, beg Hezbollah to stop their missile attacks on Tel Aviv. And what we saw in this last war was nowhere is safe in Israel, just as Sayyid Nasrallah promised. If you looked carefully before Israel finally had to bend to the truce, was basically that Hezbollah were violating, maybe 400 or 500 missiles were violating Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Haifa. They were violating these territories constantly. So all I saw during my lifetime of watching Sayyid Nasrallah was a man who was victorious on a personal level in the terms of his people and in terms of the oppressed in the region. And for that, one has to just constantly laud the leadership and the power and the kind of pride which is reinstilled within all the oppressed in that region.
Thank you, Sayyid. And Batul, why was the occupation so threatened by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, where, to Sayyid's point, they tried so many times over the years to assassinate him, where they leveled an entire city block in Dahiya in late September for his martyrdom?
Right. Ultimately, because the goal of political action is to reach the public and to turn objectives into a movement. With Sayyid Nasrallah, we saw truth in an era of deception. We saw truth in the sense of real action, truth in the sense of ideology and methodology. This led to achievements that were building up. Sayyid Nasrallah created an undefeatable party, regardless of the battles. Defeat is merely the feeling of being defeated, but he led the transformation, activating the immense latent heritage in people's beliefs into movement, you know, in the same way that Imam Khomeini did this through the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So this heritage was not created by Sayyid Nasrallah, but his role was in its activation. He created a party that ultimately refined souls, changed mindsets. He elevated the level of political engagement domestically. Everyone sought to catch up with him and to emulate him. And ultimately, the goal of political parties is to reach the public with their ideas. You know, they strive through speeches, through publications, through seminars, to influence, to elevate people's awareness to a certain level. And Sayyidina Salah, ultimately, we see this with his blood. We see the power of Sayyidina Salah when he was alive through his blood. We see today how his blood has transformed the nation from this mass quantity of people into quality. And the blood is the necessary price to pay for this transformation. It's the taxation of this process. And the crowds that we saw today, you know, this nation that we saw today, they would have come out in their masses also if they knew that Sayyidina Salah was going to be with them speaking in public. It's not the case that because he's been killed that they're coming out. No, if he was actually coming out to meet the people and to greet them, they would have come out in their hundreds of thousands as well. And so this crowd that we saw today, it cannot be subdued under any circumstances. That nation will reach its goals because it follows this path, it possesses this vision, it carries the spirit. Today we're at a stage where the resistance party's body has advanced beyond its leadership. And we see that the masses who rally behind the resistance have advanced even beyond the party's body after deeply internalizing its principles. The bloodshed has turned their beliefs, the beliefs of the masses, into real momentum. So through turning the Secretary General into a martyr, the party's body has become stronger and more driven than its leadership, and its public have become more driven than the party's body. And for this reason, you see that the resistance, without even giving orders, it relied on the masses to go to the south of Lebanon, to go to the border, to confront the Israeli tanks at zero distance, and to ultimately liberate the villages of the south with their bare flesh. Mm. In the face of that, what is the enemy able to do?
And Sayed, what do we learn today from this epic turnout for the funeral procession of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, of Sayyid Hashem Safieddin in Beirut and elsewhere? In Iran, in Iraq, even in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in Yemen, all over the world, there are simultaneous processions that took place today. And what do we learn from these?
Well, what we learn is there is popular support for Hezbollah, and we learn that Hezbollah is confident, it's strong, and it's powerful. It remains intact, you know, even in spite of all the hasbara that they're trying to pump out to say how weakened Hezbollah is and how they're not able to be politically as effective. All of that is washed away with this one gathering. What you've seen is defiance, unity, you've seen resilience, and you can see the determination of the General Secretary named Qasim in his vows to fight on, and his commitment to the resistance, even until martyrdom for himself as well. And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei, we also saw the support coming from that that front. The resistance will continue, he said. Of course, people like Sheikh Zakzaki I mentioned, but other leaders, lots of the IRGC and the Islamic Republic's leaders were there, and other dignitaries who all hold Sayyid Nasrallah in great esteem have all shown, and the Yemenis, not least of all the Yemenis, they've shown that actually they are also resilient and united and in defiance to American hegemony. Of course, the Americans are trying to embed themselves in Lebanon, but they're going to find that, I think, that they are going to fail in their efforts to divide and to destroy Lebanon from within, because that's the main tactic that Israel has now got. They can't defeat the Hezbollah movement or the Lebanese people militarily. They've seen that. So their next effort now is all invested in trying to divide and destroy internally. And that's, I think, where Hezbollah's main concentration has been to defend. But on the borders, don't forget, we've got Daesh, the ISIS fraternity, all the Anglo-Zionist-backed Julani types. They're now trying to hem in Hezbollah from one side, and of course the Israelis, who are so depleted, they can't face Hezbollah in any effective way. They may try to get this kind of ragtag organization in Syria to somehow try to give Hezbollah problems as well, but I think that they're going to find it's a very hard nut to crack, and I guess all we can do is that the legacy of Sayyid Nasrallah would be best served by seeing the complete liberation of Lebanon, all of South Lebanon, and the liberation of Palestine, because he's a Shia leader. And the Hasbara and the Takfiris generally try to pump out this division between Shia and Sunni. But Sayyid Nasrallah is a fantastic example of how a Shia dies for the Sunnis of Palestine. That in itself is another total destruction that he's caused. Even in his death, he's caused destruction of the Western and Israeli plans.
time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe to the both of you. Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst there, and also Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political analyst, both joining us from London. And this brings us to the conclusion of the segment of your OOP Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents and commentaries of chapter Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 32nd and 33rd verses of chapter Qasas. Let's listen to these verses and we will be back with our discussion.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أسلك يدك في جيبك تخرج بيضاء من غير سوء تخرج بيضاء من غير سوء واضمم إليك جناحك من الرهب فذلك برهانان من ربك إلى فرعون وملئه إنهم كانوا قوما فاسقين.
Insert your hand into the opening of your garment. It will come out white, without disease. And draw in your arm close to you as prevention from fear. For those are two proofs from your Lord to Pharaoh and his establishment. Indeed, they have been a people defiantly disobedient.
قال رب إني قتلت منهم نفسا فأخاف أن يقتلون.
He said, My Lord, indeed I killed from among them someone, and I fear they will kill me.
So in the previous verse, it was mentioned that the voice Moses heard in that situation in Mount Tur ordered Moses to cast his staff down. فَلَمَّا رَآهَا تَهْتَزُّ كَأَنَّهَا جَانٌّ وَلَّى مُدْبِرًا وَلَمْ يُعَقِبْ يَا مُوسَى أَقْبِلْ وَلَا تَخَفْ إِنَّكَ مِنَ الْآمِنِ So it was like a serpent. Moses feared and he turned back, retreating. He did not return, but it was ordered to him. It was said to him that you should come forward
and you should not fear, because at this rank we have no room for any fear. But this is the first miracle. The first miracle of Moses is that his staff became a serpent. It was a sign of terror. And after that, Moses is ordered to apply his second miracle, which is a sign of light and hope. And both of them are a combination of warning and glad tidings. أسلك يدك في جيبك تخرج بيضاء من غير سوء. Now enter your hand into your bosom, and it will come forth white and radiant without evil. وضمم إليك جناحك من الرهب. And draw your arm to yourself to ward off fear. فذانك برهانان من ربك. And these two miracles are two proofs from your Lord. إلى فرعون, unto Pharaoh, وملئه, and his chief, إنهم كانوا قوما فاسقين. Verily, they have been a transgressing people. And also, it is interesting that in the 33rd verse, we read that Moses says, قال ربي إني قتلت منهم نفسا فأخاف أن يقتلون. He said, my Lord, verily I've killed one of them, so I fear that they would slay me. So, Moses, in this verse, is ordered to enter his hand into his bosom. This whiteness and radiance that came forth from his hand was not because of the disease of leprosy and the like. It was a divine light for Moses, which was completely new. And the observation of those wonderful supernatural events in that dark night and in that empty desert, these are what caused Moses, alayhi salam, to shake vigorously in order that he could regain his peace and calmness. He was ordered another commandment, and it is this: وَضْمُمْ إِلَيْكَ جَنَاحَكَ مِنَ الرَّحْبِ. Draw your arm to yourself to ward off fear. So Moses, in that situation that we were explaining, is fearful because he has seen all these wonderful supernatural events in that dark night where he has left his family and children back in that dark, cold night. And he's experiencing all this natural thing for, I mean... not necessarily, but a natural thing for somebody to happen is to be afraid, to be scared. So it is another commandment from the Almighty Allah. وَضْمُمْ إِلَيْكَ جَنَاحَكَ مِنَ الرَّحْبِ. Draw your arm to yourself to ward off fear. In this regard, some commentators have said that this sentence ironically means the necessity of decisiveness and firm decision in fulfillment of the responsibility of prophethood. And this is the means for, this actually comes to mean that there is no fear and horror from any rank in any power in that situation, because in the previous verse it was mentioned, لا تخف إنك من الآمنين. Fear you not, for surely you are in security. Dear listeners, regarding this verse, some other commentators have also mentioned that when this staff was turned into a snake, Moses stretched his arm to defend himself, but Allah ordered him to draw back his arms, so he should not fear because he don't need to defend himself. Now, the application of the word janah instead of hand, walmum janahaka, is a beautiful meaning, and perhaps its purpose is to liken the state of man's tranquility and calmness to the state of a bird when it actually observes a frightening thing. It flies, but when it regains its calmness, it gathers its wings. So, anyway, again Moses heard the same voice saying, فَذَانِكَ بُرْهَانَانِ مِنْ رَبِّكَ, and these two miracles are two proofs from your Lord unto Pharaoh. Not just unto Pharaoh, إِلَى فِرْعَوْنَ وَمَلَئِهِ, into Pharaoh and his own people. But Moses said that Allah, I am afraid because I have killed one of them. So Moses remembers that important event, which we will discuss later on. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Nigerian Senate said the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, is accused of sponsoring terrorist groups, including the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram. The Nigerian legislative body said this is a weighty allegation which should be thoroughly investigated. The lawmakers said USAID and other non-governmental organizations had given many Nigerians cause to question their motives in the troubled northeast of Nigeria. Leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Jazaki, has always said that the United States and other Western countries are complicit in the sponsor of Boko Haram terrorists in Nigeria. Boko Haram is an insurgent group that started in 2009 and has killed tens of thousands of Nigerians in frequent brutal attacks. Over 2 million Nigerians have been displaced from their homes, in addition to destruction of hospitals, schools, and basic infrastructure by Boko Haram. The allegation that said that USAID is sponsoring Boko Haram, another terrorist, came as a startling revelation to many Nigerians, but experts are not surprised.
When you look at the antecedents of the United States, you see that they have been involved in either financing or stoking ember of discord around the world, only to further their own cause. For example, after they damaged Libya, damaged Iraq, and tried to damage Afghanistan, this was when they began to send in their military industrial complexes.
Experts argue that if allegations of USAID sponsoring terrorism prove true, it would be a striking irony. The United States has long presented itself as a global leader in counterterrorism, but such a revelation would severely undermine its moral authority on the world stage. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
The Zulfaqar military exercises officially begun in southern Iran, covering the Mokran coasts, the Oman Sea, and the northern Indian Ocean. All four branches of the country's military units, with their infantry, armored and mechanized forces, along air defense systems, warships, and submarines, are involved. These drills are designed to enhance Iran's readiness and strengthen its defensive capabilities against any potential threat.
The goal of these exercises is to strengthen our defense and deterrence capabilities against any ground, air, or maritime threats, while also testing new tactics. By conducting such drills, we'll be evaluating new, smart, and precise weapons and ammunition, including all types of domestically made missiles. Special attention will also be given to critical and current issues, such as electronic warfare, cyber operations, drones, and emerging technologies that could change the battlefield.
As the drills unfold, a significant phase has already taken place, focused on intelligence-based operations and reinforcing security measures. This exercise is laying the foundation for more advanced operational phases, with further drills set to test everything from air and ground coordination to high-tech defense systems. Key moments during the exercises include the successful interception of an enemy drone by a MiG-29 fighter jet and airstrikes carried out by F-4E bombers. Additionally, submarine-launched torpedoes and advanced helicopter operations have also shown the ever-growing strength of Iran's naval capabilities.
These maneuvers highlight Iran's self-reliance through its advanced and domestically built arsenal, while also underscoring its commitment to strengthening its military capabilities and ensuring readiness to respond to any changes in the region. Ali Ramazani, Kalat.
Arriving to a hero's welcome, Ben Jamal, director of the UK-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign, appears at his pre-trial, charged with public order offenses following a major pro-Palestine rally in London last month, which he was an organizer of. Supporters say he was unfairly charged.
I'd like them to dismiss this as ridiculous charges, the whole thing, and just let him walk free.
We want the court to drop all charges against Ben Jamal, not just Ben Jamal, but every single person who's been unjustly arrested by the police over the last 16 months. There's been so many arrests, and they've been politically motivated.
The demonstration in question took place on January 18th. The Metropolitan Police had approved the organizers' proposed route from the BBC's headquarters to Whitehall, but reversed course ahead of the march, saying it would disturb services at a synagogue.
It's a complete and utter fabrication. There have been no threats to synagogues or to Jewish worshippers. Every single demonstration has had hundreds and hundreds of Jewish protesters. If there was even the slightest threat to Jews or to synagogue worshippers, those same Jewish protesters and thousands of others would do all we could to protect the synagogue, to protect Jews, because fundamentally, these Palestine demonstrations are anti-racist, against all racism, including anti-Semitism.
The pressure to clamp down on the Palestine Solidarity protest came from pro-Israel groups like the Board of Deputies of British Jews, pro-Israel MPs, and Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, who has supported Israel's use of force against Palestinians. In addition to their outrage over the 77 arrests on January 18th, the protesters here say they're worried about their right to protest.
We saw the Public Order Act brought in by the Conservative government, which brought in loads of powers to continue to suppress and oppress the right to protest and make it more and more difficult for people to protest. And, you know, lots of people called that out at the time, and that was a Conservative policy. But it's something that's been upheld by the Labour government, and I think that's what's really terrifying. And we are, lots of people saying that we're taking a step back and moving into incredibly dark times.
In the same month as those arrests, Britain saw Israeli General Oded Bazhyak and his delegation visiting the UK with special diplomatic immunity. A member of the Israeli military, Bazhyak was involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its offensive in southern Lebanon.
This is arguably a dangerous moment for British democracy. That fear shared by the protesters here who say they feel they live in a country that grants diplomatic immunity to war criminals who oversaw genocide, and yet it persecutes those who organized peaceful protests aimed solely at stopping that very genocide. Saeed Pourreza, London.
After almost 1 month of the ceasefire in Gaza, life has not changed a lot, particularly for people here in Deir el-Balah, which was once the main haven for the displaced people. A lot of families here, hundreds of families, are still stranded in tents, in leaky and dilapidated tents, with no means of protection at all. People here are desperate for water, food, and every essential need. However, they are without anything, without any life means inside their tents. And their suffering is being doubled and tripled and even quadrupled because of the continuously dropping temperatures and the low pressure fronts expected to hit the territory in the coming weeks. Now, for them, as Israel is still obstructing the aid and the entry of caravans and mobile homes into Gaza, they don't know how they can cope with the current situation. And their only solution is just to take shelter in those dilapidated and flimsy tents, which are easily flooded and blown away by the strong waves of wind and the torrential rain.
Our home is no longer standing. Our home and four other houses are above each other. We can't use anything in our home. There are no intact houses here. You can barely find four. Living in tents is truly difficult and unbearable. Today, the rainwater filled our tents, so we sank in garbage and mud.
Our home was destroyed along with other four houses. The area there was bulldozed. The Israeli military is still present in our residential area. We can't bear taking shelter in tents because we are surrounded by garbage. We have drowned today due to the heavy rain which flooded our tents and wetted our clothes.
Surrounded by stagnant pools of sewage and garbage and trapped in a bubble of endless trauma, hundreds of Palestinian families are still taking refuge in their damp and leaky tents in Deir el-Balah, as their homes have been destroyed by the Israeli military and the residential areas are still beleaguered by Israeli forces. Despite all the horrors they have been through, they're trying to alleviate the grim reality of living after the ceasefire. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir el-Balah, Gaza.
Relying only on their phones, Bisan Auda and Ahmed Ghunem, known as Ahmed Alive, put the genocide in Gaza by Israel on display for the world to see. In a documentary by former war correspondent and Scene Palestine TV co-founder Yusuf Omar, the journey of two resilient journalists in Gaza breaks through the selective reporting of the Western mainstream media. In its New York screening, the double feature relayed raw footage filmed by Bisan and Ahmed documenting the genocide as it unfolds. The producer, Yusuf Omar, told us many of his screenings were canceled in Canada and the U.S. after venues called the film political, as he delved into the issue of media hypocrisy.
When they found out that we were showcasing Palestinian films from Gaza, for various reasons, they decided, hey, we can't work with you anymore. And it's just really sad. I think when you hear about North America, you think about it as like freedom of expression and like a free press. We go to journalism conferences around the world and you see the media crying their eyes out when they speak about Ukraine. But yet when you hear about journalists out of Gaza losing their lives, nothing. Absolute silence. The hypocrisy is absolutely insane. We've seen, as you say, over 200 journalists have been killed. It is the most dangerous place on earth to be a journalist. More journalists have been killed in Gaza than at any point in recently recorded history.
At least 217 journalists have been killed since October 7, 2023 by Israel. And yet, those crimes have not been accounted for, nor have the occupation and its allies been held accountable, especially as much as the media polishes it.
The reason why Israel get away with it is because they are their own police. When the U.S. are asked about these crimes, they say, well, Israel are investigating it. That's like the criminal investigating, or it's like the criminal being the judge in their own case. The ability for content and journalism and storytelling to change hearts and minds is quite an incredible thing. People underestimate it. For so long, traditional media has dehumanized Arab populations, and that's how we've helped create consent for a genocide. People are craving raw, real, authentic voices from the ground, and that's why we're working with all these citizens.
Scene Palestine is working with 50 storytellers in Gaza from the youngest age of 12, using their phones to reveal both the tragic reality on the ground and the brave spirits of the children creating life again from the rubble. The targeting of journalists in Gaza and in Lebanon has been blatantly ignored by preachers of international law. Nevertheless, and despite threats, both Bisan and Ahmad refuse to be silenced by conspiring governments and the mainstream media as they embody the true meaning of journalism. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
We are currently inside the Al-Jawazat security compound, which is located in the central area of Gaza City, documenting how the situation looks like after the Israeli occupation forces targeted this place and this area for multiple times. We are still witnessing and documenting this massive and widespread destruction and devastation inflicted in this area. Buildings were targeted, destroyed, and leveled to the ground by the Israeli tanks and the Israeli F-16 fighter jets. Wherever we turn our camera, we can document how the Israeli forces deliberately targeted the buildings of this compound. This compound was the main security compound in Gaza Strip because it included several departments, several security agencies. So it's not worthy that targeting this compound hasn't taken place far away from targeting the policemen in the streets, the individuals were responsible for securing the humanitarian supplies. I cannot read exactly what is written down here in the Hebrew language, but it appears that these are the messages the Israeli forces wanted to deliver the Palestinian people, trying desperately to show more force and dominance.
Definitely, the main aim of targeting the security buildings was creating a chaotic situation and pushing the people to rebel against Hamas ruling. The Israeli drones were enabling the looters and gangs to move freely and steal the humanitarian aid, while the law enforcement individuals and policemen were targeted intentionally. It's all systematic.
So, as you can see right now, we have some explosive war remnants that were left behind the Israeli occupation forces. It's not worthy that thousands of those objects are still scattered elsewhere in Gaza Strip. Unequivocally, targeting the security agencies, departments, and buildings was completely systematic by the Israeli occupation forces. And it came in the context of the fixed policy used and adopted by the Israeli regime in order to create more chaos on the ground here in Gaza Strip and targeting the internal front of the Palestinian people. Mutab Musabbeh, Gaza City.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians remain displaced in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin and its refugee camp as an Israeli offensive there enters its second month. The displaced residents gathered at the eastern entrance of the Jenin camp to retrieve what remains of their necessities. Israeli forces, however, prevented them from even approaching the camp after initially allowing them to go there. We went after the occupation, coordinated with the Palestinian liaison so that we could enter the camp. But after we gathered, they prevented us. We were displaced since the first day because we were trapped in Ibn Sina Hospital, and I have been unable to enter the camp since Tuesday when the special forces came in. We miss our lives and homes in the camp very much. We wish we could have stayed and not been displaced. We were displaced to the area surrounding the camp, but the camp remains dear to us.
As the Israeli assault continues, the extent of the widespread destruction of homes and other properties in different parts of Jenin and its refugee camp is becoming clearer each day. Regime forces at the same time are sending military reinforcements along with bulldozers and fuel tankers to the camp and its surrounding areas.
I'm going to check on my home that was burned down. My house was completely burned. I am the aunt of the martyr Ibrahim al-Kunairi and the aunt of the martyr Rahab al-Ashkar, whose body was held for 10 days. It's sorrow upon sorrow. I have no shelter or place to settle after this displacement.
According to the United Nations, the current mass displacement is unprecedented in the occupied West Bank over the past years. That comes as Israel has expanded its Jenin offensive to other areas in the northern West Bank.
As the operation moved into its second month, thousands are fleeing Jenin due to the ongoing demolitions by the Israeli army, marking the largest displaced in decades across the occupied West Bank. Tiba Asi, occupied Jenin.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, respect for all people. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, here on IRB English Radio. So I've titled the topic for today, respect for all people. And I'm going to actually narrow it down a little bit. So I'm talking, first of all, about a little incident from the life of the famous martyr Ibrahim Hadi. So during the War of Holy Defence, also called the Imposed War, some of the Iraqi captives had been brought to the city where he was. And so he had responsibility to look after them. And so what was happening was that, so he gave them food. And so obviously, so this meant that the captives were also sort of, in a sense, attracted to this good behavior, this good akhlaq of his. And he'd also talk with them. So he was displaying just such good care and behavior towards them that they even wanted to fight with him against the Ba'athis. So, and you know, this is something, there were some very, let's say, meaningful outcomes of his behavior towards captives, for example, towards their, like their enemies, basically, such that some of the Iraqis obviously did fight with them. Then they went and they formed a unit, and yeah, some of them became some of the sort of very famous martyrs on the Iranian side. So, but obviously this is about, what does this mean, respect for all people? So this is very specific, and look, even nowadays in the region, we see this, that we have very strict rules, even with enemies, and especially when we're taking, for example, what we call captives, or prisoners of war. And this is spelled out for us very much so in the Quran. And Imam Ali would talk about this, how we're supposed to treat. Welcome back. This is A to Z and IB English Radio. And so I'm talking about respect for people, and been talking about how, for example, Ibrahim Hadi, the famous martyr, would treat the captives from Iraq during the War of Holy Defence. And obviously, so respecting people and also respecting and caring properly about the captives, the prisoners of war, this sort of goes together. And there's two strands to this. Obviously, one is that we appreciate the other person's dignity as a human being. So even if this is our enemy, even if this is a prisoner of war. And there's another element in there that is really important, because imagine if Yeah, and let's just sort of talk about this in a more general way. If we are, let's say, whether you want to think about people you really don't like, call them enemies, maybe there's just people you really don't like at work, and you know, obviously we wouldn't. So let's take it down to the micro level. First, you've got people at work. Maybe you've got a boss, or maybe you have some very troublesome, let's say, members of family in the bigger extended family, and you're thinking, oh, this person's akhlaq is terrible. Why can't I behave like that towards them? But no, we shouldn't be like that. If we then counter them with really good akhlaq, very often, not always, of course, but very often, that sort of stops them from even being able to sort of continue with bad akhlaq, because it surprises people. It's difficult, genuinely, for people to counter, like say, kindness with unkindness. So, you know, we might already sort of be doing the right thing just through doing that. And obviously, if we take it to the bigger level, a macro level, again, imagine obviously if we as Muslims, if we're treating, you know, in the political arena, if we've got prisoners of war, if we have captives, you know, if we are the ones who are treating them really well, exactly the way we should as per the Quran, then obviously people will be looking at us and thinking, oh, look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Look at how well they're being treated. That is Islam. Because, you know, as Muslims, both in our small spheres and in the global arena, it's our role to always be the best people we can be. Every single one of us is representing and propagating Islam through our behavior, inshallah. So thank you for listening in for today, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
The Zionist regime has shot 8-year-old Jannat in the face, and the Western media ignored it, as it always do. Jannat Mettour's life was forever altered when an Israeli soldier's bullet struck her, leaving her blind and shattered by trauma. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Jannat never imagined that her room would become the site of a terrifying memory that would change her life forever. In a single moment, the Palestinian girl was subjected to a life-altering accident in her own room, losing her sight in both eyes, all because of the Zionist regime army bullets. Her life and the life of her family was completely turned upside down, forever shattering the dreams of this once cheerful, energetic girl. On February 11th, Jannat Mettour was playing with her two younger brothers in the room when she heard the sound of the Zionist regime army storming her town of Sair, east of Al-Khalil. As the eldest and only sister, driven by love and compassion, she rushed to get her 3-year-old brother Muhammad off the bed and away from danger. She then approached the window, intending to close it. Her father, Faisal, was with her mother in the living room when they heard Jannat's scream, her voice filled with terror. They rushed to her room and found her lying in a pool of blood. Faisal said, I saw a fountain of blood on my daughter's head. I couldn't see her face or features. Her two brothers were crying from the horror of the sight. She was crying and screaming for help. An Israeli soldier bullet had struck her while she was trying to close the window to protect her brothers. Her father picked her up and ran outside, trying to get her to the nearest hospital. However, the Zionist regime troops had surrounded the house, blocking anyone from leaving. Faisal was forced to keep her on the stairs until the soldiers allowed them to depart. More than half an hour later, they were finally given permission to leave, but without an ambulance. They had no choice but to use her uncle's vehicle, Faisal explained. Because there was a closed iron gate at the entrance to our town, we couldn't reach the hospital.